You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You're listening to the ESPN Footy Podcast.
G'day everybody, welcome back to the ESPN Footy Podcast for another week. Matt Walsh, Jake Michaels, champion darters Christian Jolly here to talk all things footy for another week. 18 teams gathered in Adelaide, Jake, 9 emerged winners, and there were some very interesting storylines to emerge from a big week of footy. There's heaps to get to as per usual. We're looking at how teams fare late in quarters, the inconsistent Bombers. We're going to look ahead to a couple of this week's huge clashes and some fun records that were set in Gather Round. But before we get into it, something from the weekend you noticed?
I noticed a lot from the weekend. It was a very busy weekend. Gather Round, as you said,
yes,
was a whole lot of fun. And we'll get into that a little later. But there was a lot of things I noticed from there. But the one thing I've noticed in the last hour was... So Lachie Neale's about to play his 250th game.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just putting together a bit of a how good is this guy type piece.
One of your favourites.
One of my favourite players, but I still think a touch underrated, which sounds crazy for a two-time Brownlow medalist, but I still think he is, and I'll explain why.
Yes.
But just looking at his win-loss and draw record, I noticed that he's never played in a draw.
Right.
So 249 games to this point and no draw as yet. A couple of close calls. Won't go back to the grand final. But... I asked Christian, is that the most of a current player with no draws?
And it was a teammate 4 games ahead of him, Dane Zorko, who's 253 games
there
at the moment
go.
Without
so
a draw.
Close.
So very close. And that, yeah, going back into history, it was John Blakey who actually played 359 games and finished his career without a draw.
No
so that's
draws.
The most you've got to get to.
What's the average number of draws per 100 games? Like, is there kind of like
it's
a,
about 1%,
you play an
right?
Is it 1%? Is that right?
It's about 1.5 per season. So if you go to 196 game season, 1.5.
So John Blakey rolled the dice and
then
never
came
up.
And then you got Jack Riewoldt, who's played in 8 draws.
Yeah, that's right. I remember when he retired, that was one of the big stats. Yeah. He played in so many.
Well, he's got the record for the most draws.
Marlon Pickett was quite a high ratio
too. Yeah,
Marlon
Pickett, we're getting into the weeds here, but he's only played about 85-ish games and he's played in 4 draws. So there's a pretty high strike rate as well.
There you go. Christian, something from the weekend that took your fancy?
Surprised I hadn't heard this before and I thought someone was going to steal this. Collingwood subs. So obviously Scott Pendlebury hurt his ribs.
Yes.
I don't think we know the extent of that injury yet. Luckily they have the bye this week. But yeah, he obviously started on the ground and got subbed off for their starting sub, which was still side bottom. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I looked at. 700 games, 700 odd games of experience.
701.
701 games.
Which is
that's
the most
record, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's the most of anyone, and the next most is 588, which is 588 games for the Hawks in round 15, 2021. Sean Burgoyne, I think, was the starting sub, and Chad Wingard got subbed out. A few other games in between, but yeah, round 2 earlier this year, Luke Brewster and Jack Gunston were subbed on and off for Hawthorn. That was 527 games of experience. But yeah, as I said, Collingwood 701, next most 588.
That'll take some beating, I reckon.
Gee, that's not bad. I mean, that's like 120-odd clear of the next best. Maybe Flyers just having a bit of fun with that one. Hey, something I noticed, the SA Tourism Board sent out a release to some of the media in the lead-up to Gather Round, which I found really interesting because... It was a prime example of the Streisand effect, which is basically like if you hadn't brought attention to it, no one would have noticed. But they brought attention to something. They didn't want Adelaide throughout the weekend to be referred to as Radelaide or the City of Churches. And of course, went viral on Twitter. Everyone saw it. Everyone said how this is ridiculous and everyone's going to start calling it Radelaide. I've referred to it as Radelaide once or twice before, just for fun.
I reckon 5 people have asked me today how it was Radelaide.
Radelaide. And so they've asked people not to do this. I mean, the City of Churches, every time you see the cricket on and you got the background, it's like, it's always the City of Churches.
Are there that many churches in Adelaide?
It's a great question. Maybe that's what they're a bit... They're like, hey, we actually don't have that many. Yeah, we don't want to be known as this. But I just thought that was so funny. It was kind of like when the Bureau of Meteorology came out and was like, we don't want to be called the Bomb anymore. They want to be called the Bureau.
That didn't last too long.
And it was about a week and a half. Everyone was like, it's just the bomb. Everyone knows it's the bomb. We're going to call it the bomb. So, Radelaide, SA Tourism want it.
Well, I found those two terms weird that they were sort of interchangeable in the same press release, because the City of Churches feels a bit more prestigious. But it feels a bit more, a bit more of a prestige name, whereas Radelaide is just something you use sort of around mates. It's like, are they really the same sort of, you know, isn't the City of Churches
on Hindley Street calling it Radelaide? Let's crack into it, Jake. While we are on Gather Round in Adelaide, how was your experience? Because you did go over there. You didn't go last time.
No.
But second year now, you would have think they've ironed out some kinks. Did you enjoy your time over in Radelaide?
I did. I must say, I really did. And as you know, I was a little sceptical, not about the event, but I guess everyone that goes and everyone that went last year came back, media were talking about it and raved about it, and it was great, how awesome it was. But I was still unsure whether that was the true experience that the fans are going to get, or if that's just general media having
media,
you know, paid to go and you know, enjoying it with their fellow media mates. So being able to go spend time at all three grounds, and speaking to dozens of people, it was great. The atmosphere was fantastic. Seeing the people, just the amount of people in Adelaide, decked out in every single team gear. It was just really, really cool to see. The games were good. I know it got off to a bit of a shaky start with a couple of blowouts, but the games for the most part were quite good. Mm. The weather was great. The city, the activations around the city, I think it was just ticks all across the board. The only thing I will double down on, and I'll die on this hill, is how difficult the tourism industry is making it for people to get there.
Interesting.
We spoke about this on Red Time on Thursday. The cost of flights was just astronomical. Hotel prices, 3-4 times what they normally are for any other weekend in Adelaide. And it's just made it very difficult for people to go. And I wrote about this, and as I said, I spoke to dozens of people that had travelled from either Melbourne or from Perth, some people from Tassie.
Wow.
And everyone came back with a very similar story, that it got to the point where it's so expensive. Yes, it's enjoyable, but don't know if it's something that they would come back and do next year because of the cost. And you look at the costs associated with it, and, you know, for, say, a family of four to go for a weekend, and for flights of four and hotel and match tickets, and if you're going, you're probably not going to want to go to one game. You want to maximize it, so people go to 2-3 games, and food and drink and transport and everything else that goes along with it. You can take your family overseas for a week, instead of a weekend in Adelaide. Yeah. So I guess that's a trade-off.
Well, you were saying that like $4,000 or $5,000 some of these families were paying.
$4,000 or $5,000 easily.
Yeah,
easily, without even going over the top, and it's, you know, you're spending, for a family of four, you can easily spend close to $3,000 on the flights, such as the price hike. So I think, but what do you do? This is not a new issue that I guess the world faces with any major event. It's not an AFL specific issue. It's not a sports specific issue. We've seen this, we see this all the time, but I don't know what can be done.
Yeah, I think it's just the reality of it is the airline industry, they can do what they want. The hotels can do what they want. So the AFL can sort of say, hey, you know, please. Mm. And I know that in the first year, the AFL and Virgin Australia did have a partnership where they had a certain number of plane tickets at reduced prices. But of course, they go so quickly that pops up.
The average person doesn't even know that's a thing.
And so it is really difficult. And I think, kind of from what you've been telling me, that people were enjoying themselves, but there was that sort of sour taste in the back of the mouth of, gee, this has cost us a lot of money.
I think that's exactly it.
It's the irony of being gathered around. It's just like, gather around, but like they're reaching into my back pocket and pulling out my wallet.
Quite tricky to do.
So what do you think of the concept going forward? Like, will it continue to work?
I think it will continue to work, and I think Adelaide is the city where it will work best. Yeah. With all due respect to every other major capital city, Adelaide is where this works.
It's a great spot.
100%. I know they played at three venues, but Norwood's not too far out of this. Norwood's basically in the city as well, and Adelaide Oval is just a walk across the bridge. But
Mount Barker's it's just a hike. That was something I noticed. I was way further out than I anticipated.
But it's a perfect city if you think of all the Australian cities, and just compare it to somewhere like Sydney, where you went to Adelaide during Gather Round, and I'm sure you can walk down Hindley Street or Rundlemore and you can tell it is just footy people everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it was in Sydney or even here in Melbourne, the city's so spread out that you probably wouldn't have that whole concentration of, oh, the whole street feels like they're all here for Gather Round. You wouldn't even sort of rub shoulders with another footy fan if you went to Sydney. So I think Even just from what I know about Adelaide.
I just don't think you get the buy-in in Sydney anywhere near as much as what
I think they've nailed the location, the timing, all that stuff. I think they've
I think, you know, as a media observer, as a footy fan, as part of the media, I just would like to see a bit more of, or a bit less sort of that media washing and understanding that people do get paid to do this. I mean, you know, I was told of one person who works at a media company and other people at the media company realise that, hang on, the media company hadn't paid for this person to go to gather round, meaning that, you know, the AFL might have. Yeah. So, like, these are the kind of things that I guess that, like, it just sort of falls through the cracks a lot with a lot of these people, and they can sing from the rooftops all they like that it's
hence
this wonderful
the skepticism
thing.
Going
yeah,
in.
Yeah, and you, I think it's important to have both points of view.
Yeah.
So obviously it went really well. Crowds were pretty good.
Yeah.
The enjoyment aspect of it, but you know, like you said, you spoke to dozens of people and families that enjoyed it, but at a cost, right?
Yeah. And I guess the too long didn't read version is it is a great event. I would recommend everyone to go. All footy fans should go. It's awesome in so many ways, but yes, that is going to be the trickiest
Save
point
up.
So it's I guess it's not changing, so try and book early when you can and
guess for the weekend
these rates. And I tell you what, here's a little sneaky tip as I wrote in the story. The hotel prices 2 weeks out, the hotel prices were $500 a night for the hotel. The week of, it went down to 400, then 350. They're going down as it's getting closer too, which kind of suggests, well, are they selling them? Have they just tried to put them up to begin with and see what they can sell? So don't fire off too early. Maybe
so when you find out that they're $1,000 a hotel room when you're trying to book it last minute next year, Jake
just
is the
as
man.
Just as you're landing into Adelaide Airport, then just go on the old booking.
Right, let's talk some footy. Christian, we had some tight finishes in round five. Jake, as you kind of mentioned, the weekend sort of started slowly, I guess, from a results perspective, but kind of grew into it. I guess it kind of actually came to a bit of a head on Saturday afternoon, evening with that Carlton-Fremantle thing.
Certainly
the Blues came from behind late again to kind of pinch it from the Dockers. And we might try and leave a bit of that controversy behind. I feel like it's been about 3 days of just wall-to-wall umpires and dissent and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know what much more we can add or take away from it. So we'll leave that to one side.
Yep.
The Hawks obviously almost pulled off the heist against the Pies, which would have been a very interesting result. The Dogs fell 4 points short against the Cats. The Saints and Tigers was tight too. So it got us thinking about, I guess, teams which can perform late. And we broaden this out a bit. So Christian, which teams have been the kings of kicking more goals than their opponents in the dying minutes of quarters? And I guess we kind of had to put a mark on this, right? So after, let's say, the 25th minute mark of a quarter, are there teams that do it consistently better than others?
Probably not as a quick synopsis of it, but there's some clear teams at the top that you would expect. So looking at how many goals you've kicked after the 25-minute mark of any quarter since the start of last year, and Collingwood's done it the most. So Collingwood, and again, sorry, this is differential. Collingwood have outscored their opposition by 31 goals.
Sorry, going back to when, sorry?
Start of last year,
my apologies.
So they're plus 31 goals from the 25-minute mark of quarters, so they've scored 31 more goals late in quarters than their opposition, which is the best differential of any team, and it's sort of what we know about Collingwood. They're always
so in that time,
in the game,
82
strongly.
Goals for after the 25-minute mark of any quarter, and only 51 against.
Yes, so which gives them a differential.
What do you mean 82-4? Like 82 goals four behind?
No, they're very accurate as well. The later it goes, they get very accurate. So 31 more goals than their opposition. Before the 25-minute mark, they're plus 38 goals from their opposition anyway. So they're a type of team that outscores their opposition, obviously, last 2 years, premiership winners, and right up the top of the ladder. Probably the first sort of interesting one that I sort of noticed was probably Richmond at one end. So they're, before the 25-minute mark of all quarters, they're negative 44 goals. So they've been outscored by 44 goals in the first 25 minutes of quarters. They're plus 12 in the after the 25-minute mark. So I don't know if that's
the
one
late
of the teams.
Flurry.
Yeah, I don't know if that's one of the teams that would have instantly thought about as strong finishes, but that's, as the numbers say.
Coming to this sort of question and this query was very interesting because I swear on the Footy Tips Twitter, sometimes we just get people that are venting about their team. I swear to God, Hawthorn, they give up goals late in quarters all the time.
But everyone always thinks it's their team that do it as
well. Everyone thinks it's their team. So I guess this is a nice way to kind of differentiate it. So the Tigers, obviously actually good at sort of scoring late.
They're
obviously
getting outscored against most quarters, and that's, obviously haven't been up in the finals for the last in this time that we're looking at. But plus 12 in the final after the 25-minute mark of each quarter, so they do finish quarter stronger. And again, just looking at goals against total, they've played a few extra games because of finals in here, Brisbane, but they've conceded 84 goals after the 25-minute mark, which is the equal second most of any team. Eagles, 108 goals they've conceded after the 25-minute mark, and Kangaroos are at 84. So Brisbane's up there. I know they've played, I think they've got three extra games
Yeah, okay.
They've had the bye this year. So, yeah, three extra games in their pocket compared to West Coast and North Melbourne. But, yeah, conceding the 84 late quarter goals, which is quite a lot, but they've kicked 91 themselves. Yeah. So they still end up in the positive. But if there is one supporter group that probably could sort of draw, you know, going back to your footy tips one, it's probably Brisbane supporters that probably think, geez, we are pretty good defensively for most of the quarter. Teams seem to kick goals against them quite well late. And sort of, yeah, another team that's interesting is Port Adelaide. So across most of the quarters, so before the 25-minute mark of quarters, they've outscored their opposition by 48 goals. But after the 25-minute mark in the last 2 years, they're negative 10 goals. So another one that's
a really big drop off.
Yeah, so it's a you know a differential of 58 between their pre-25-minute mark.
Is that the biggest differential of any team either way?
Yeah, it was. So GWS was the next biggest, but they were positive both ways. So 58 goal swing for Port Adelaide pre-25-minute and post-25-minutes. GWS go from plus 52 goals before the 25-minute mark and plus 8 goals after the 25-minute mark, which sort of stacks up. You've got less time to score, obviously, after the 8-minute mark. Yeah. So they've got a 44-goal differential, but again, still in the positive for outscoring.
Yeah, so you've got Port Adelaide in the bottom four of those teams in terms of the differential, but the other teams there, obviously West Coast, North Melbourne and Hawthorn, which makes a lot of sense, but it's Port Adelaide, which are really sort of struggling to do it late in games as well.
Yeah, and
it has to be something that they're aware of.
Right? Again, well,
coaching for it? I mean, how do you coach, I guess?
But looking at this,
but what do you put it down
negative
to?
10, it's negative 10 goals. So when we're looking at it for a query that we've just been asked and putting it in the table, you can see it, but I don't know if this is really enough for Ken Hinkley.
But they're plus 48 in other times, though.
Yeah, but it would be something you're aware of, but I don't think, again, I don't think negative 10 goals across
it's not enough to be a concern.
It's something you'd put on a watch and think, okay, maybe we do need to end quarters a bit stronger, but it's not enough to think, oh, this is the reason why we can't get ourselves a flag or something like that.
The interesting thing that I notice out of this is that there are only 5 teams with a negative differential and every other team has a positive differential. Is this, I guess, kind of, you know, there are a few really poor teams in the competition at the moment and have been for some time, and that's why you think that more teams are doing it?
A lot of the numbers you look at, and we've spoken about it on the pod a lot of times, 16th now seems to be last because North Melbourne and West Coast are ranking 17th and 18th in so many measures across the time that if you're really looking at
and by yourself a long in way.
Comfortably,
if you're looking at yourself as a competition thinking, well, we just don't want to be 17th and 18th in any stat, then you're kidding yourself because, you know, you're never going to be that low. So it's 15, 16. So I think, even looking at the numbers, West Coast, as we said, Hawthorn, negative 20, so start at Port again, so negative 10 after the 25-minute mark, but then it goes to Hawthorn, negative 27, North Melbourne, negative 42, and West Coast, negative 69. So as I said, that's about maybe 4 or 5 minutes per game across 20 games. So that's only about, 90 to 100 minutes.
And they've been outscored
by 69 goals.
69 goals in
39-4, so they've kicked 39 goals after the 25-minute mark, conceded 108 in just that part of the quarter. So
it's part of an inexperienced and potentially younger group is they just can't quite run out full games and full quarters, and that might be part of it. Or, you pile them on late, you lose a bit of confidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they're piling on early, and then it's not like before
25 minutes.
It's a consistent theme of not being able to
kick. So teams at the top, we did mention Collingwood, so they are they're plus 31 beyond 25 minutes. So late in quarters, they are kicking 31 more goals than their opposition.
Melbourne
is second, 23. Adelaide, third with plus 22. Geelong, plus 15. Richmond, plus 12, as we said, a little bit out of the box. And Fremantle, plus 10, and then a bunch of teams sort of in those single figures. I don't know, does that sort of, I guess the eye test, does that, over what you've watched over a long period of time, anything, I mean, I guess the power is probably the one that sneaks out in Richmond.
Power a little surprising, but I don't think it's...
You're a Carlton supporter, do you think that's about fair, where the Blues are, very middle of the road?
About even, yeah, I wouldn't say that Carlton... or we give up a lot of goals. I don't know. I think it's, we're about even. There's half the teams there are around even-ish. So, I don't think it's too crazy.
Bit of a tangent on this one, and you brought this to my attention, Jake. But you wanted to know kind of about free kicks late in games as well. I guess the kind of the myth or the rumour about sort of putting the whistle away, anything like that?
A little bit. But also going back to the Carlton Freo game that we're not going to talk about, just got me thinking: are umpires more likely to pay frees or 50 meter penalties or less likely? I tend to think you could kind of go either way with it.
The long held opinion is they put their whistle away.
Yeah.
Right?
So I guess it got me thinking about that and whether we see more or less or what we see at any time of the game. So the question was put to you, Christian, about that.
Yeah, and again, I sort of didn't have no idea what the numbers were going to say when I spat it out, and I'm kind of happy that the numbers say there is completely nothing in it. So,
well, it's good to know.
Looking at what we're trying to do is basically split the game into 16 segments. So each quarter has four quarters within a quarter, just so we can sort of look at what you sort of said. Do more free kicks get paid, or do they dry up late in a close game? So what we counted as late in the close game would be your final quarter of time in the final quarter, if that makes sense.
So kind of like the last 8-ish minutes.
Yeah, depending on how long the quarter goes. So for the first 15th, 16th of the game, so leading into that, you get an average of 2.06 free kicks for every sort of per game across the...
Per period
of that time.
So, like a minute.
So they pay about eight free kicks per quarter, or just over.
So a free every like 4 minutes or so.
In the final quarter of a game that's not close, the final 16th, if you want to put it that way, so the final quarter of the final quarter, as it's written here, there's 2.15 free kicks paid, and that's if it's not a close game. So 2.06 before, 2.15 if it's not close, and bang on two if it is a close game. So very small.
There's nothing in it.
And that was just for 1 year. I ran it for 2 years, and basically the numbers are, the numbers might switch slightly, but the differential between them all is
so it's random. A myth. This is Mythbusters.
I think it is. You watch enough football.
If the free kicks are there, they get paid, right?
Yeah, correct.
But as they should be. And
I think umpires getting a bit of a...
There are so many myths and thoughts with free kick counts don't have to even up. They don't have to always finish the same.
I think we did a deep dive when Richmond was really doing well, and their game style was... like sort of lent on actually
they
giving away free kicks.
Gave away the most Hawthorn, free kicks.
Hawthorn were very
way.
Good at that. So one of the things that Hawthorn did in their three-peat was they're holding the ball with through the roof. They just got caught holding the ball twice as much as any other
Hawks
team.
The Hawks got caught holding the ball.
And that was clearly a mindset or a part of their thing is, if we're going to get tackled, instead of having a handball that might be turned over and play keeps going, just hold it in, give away a free kick, slower turnover. Yeah. So they were much happier to hold the ball. And it was ridiculously high numbers. I think their first premiership off the top of my head might have been 90 times they were conceded holding the ball, and the next most was 40, 45. So that was a clear pattern for it. And again, I think different team we spoke about last week. I think we went 1 week too early on. We spoke about Carlton forwards and the free kicks and the way sort of Carlton play in contests and things like that.
Interesting stats coming up about that.
Exactly. We went 1 week too early, but we almost foresaw what was going to happen in that game. But there's certain ways that teams play. Richmond were always in the negative of free kick count. Bulldogs always, when they were back, they always seemed to be higher because they were more ball focused and less tackling.
One of the teams that was a bit disappointing in Gather Round was Essendon. So Friday night had the marquee slot against Port Adelaide.
I think you take Gather Round out. I think they've been disappointing for quite a while now, the Bombers.
Well, they won the week before.
You go back to the end of last season. You cannot get that out of your head.
Anyway, so they pulled off the commendable win against St Kilda the week before, only to really sort of disappoint against the Power in Gather Round the next week. Prime time, Friday night footy, that whole thing. I think the thing that sort of leapt out to me is just how different they can be week to week. You talk about another sort of, not myth, but another cliche in footy is, teams that have that sort of Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing.
Well, St Kilda's another one that
win-loss last year. But the Bombers seem to be doing this to different extremes than other clubs. And I think you've got some stats that highlight just how different they play week to week. How much they struggle week to week or thrive week to week.
Yeah, so it's probably what I've compared is just wins and losses. So when they win, what do their numbers look like when they lose? So you're always going to have higher numbers in wins and things like that, but just the sheer differential is just, it's stark for Brisbane, for Essendon. So you start from points for 95 points per game they score when they win, 66 when they lose. So it's a five-goal turnaround just there. But then their points against, 74 when they win. This is going back to the start of last season as well, so taking a fair sample of games. 74 points when they win, they concede. 106 points against when they lose. So, again, it's a 60-point turnaround for and against in that way.
So extreme.
Points that they score themselves from turnovers, they score 53 points from turnovers when they win, 41 when they lose. So they lose two goals that way, which isn't great, but turnovers against, so the scores conceded from their own turnovers, 38 points when they win, 68 points when they lose. So another five goals there. So again,
what's
just looking
comp
at the turnover
there,
part
roughly?
Of
goals or points conceded from turnovers.
About the 39-40 per year, so 37.7.
So they're giving up
they're
five
just
more
under,
goals than that.
Yeah, over the average. So, and again, looking at they're losing two goals from their wins, but they're also giving up another five. So seven-goal turnaround in turnovers alone. But yeah, if you just look at, so that's just looking at them and how they're performing, wins and losses. Mm. Inside 50 differential is another one, plus 2.7 in wins, which isn't huge, but they're still in the positive. Negative 13.5 in losses. So they just get, the territory game just completely deserts them in losses. And you have a look at what they've sort of done last year compared to this year and what improvements they've made, and it's very hard to see. So that last year they were the best team at moving the ball from one end to the other. The second best team at moving it from one end to the other, had the best kicking efficiency of any
team. What does that mean? Can you explain what that means?
So you start the ball in your D50, so any chain that starts in your D50, you're the most successful at getting it to your forward 50. So that's basically how we.
So if you have a quick measure amount of chains and you convert X amount of those inside 50s, that's your. So
it's about no particular time or amount of disposal.
Without losing possession or a stoppage.
Just without losing.
So you no stoppage occurs and the opposition never got possession of the ball. So there might be a few spoils in that chain. So it might be spoiled, you pick it up.
But it was never a turnover.
Exactly.
Possession.
So you've maintained possession. They're able to do that. As I said, I think it's about.
So why can they do that as well or better than anybody?
Well,
which feels like a fundamental part of the game, yet they still.
Well, this is where my point's taken. So this is what they were good at last year. They had nailed one part of the game. They were great at moving the ball, and that was one part. And it was his first year as coach. He said, okay, he's fixed one part of the game. They are the second best team at trying to get the ball from one end to the other. Defending that ball movement, they were 17th. So North was actually harder to move the ball against from back 50 to forward 50 against Essendon. So they hadn't nailed that defensive part of their game. So you sort of looked at preseason this year, said, okay, they got one part of their game. The offense is looking okay. They know how to share the ball around. They know how to move it. Mm-hmm. Next part of their thing is either they need to get better defensively, which can be your back six not conceding score, or they just needed to get better at contest, which can help you defensively as well. Because they were even contested possession differential last year, they were down at 13th. So this year, a little bit of improvement from clearance differential, so they're and contested possession differential. So 12th for clearances last year, 3rd this year. 13th for contested possession differential, slightly in the negative, to 9th this year, basically breaking even. But as I said, their kicking efficiency, 1st last year, 17th this year. Their ball movement from back 50, 2nd last year, 17th this year. And as I said, protecting the ball, going the other way. So defending ball movement, they were 15th last year and they're down to 17th this year. So the three areas that they were good in ball use and moving the ball, they're in now bottom three.
It's gone.
Gosh. They've had slight improvement around the contest, which is, might be the Essendon edge and things like that. But
you can't give up. You can't have such a drop off in one area and just
and it's
tiny
and it's, and it's the one it's area not, that you could hang your hat on last year and say, at least if we're building a team going forward, we're going to be an offensive team. And we've spoken, I think, on the pod a few weeks ago about Essendon and scoring 100 and losing, sort of, Essendon are one of those teams that can have a high score but actually get pipped because they concede going the other way. And that's what a lot of the numbers said last year. You've got your offense going, but you've forgotten all about your defense. This year, the offense, as I said, gone, completely gone, and the defense has not improved one iota.
This is tough listening if you're an Essendon fan.
Well, it is.
Because this is, this is supposed to be the building year again, like second year under Scott. And, he's come out with a lot of promises, this Essendon edge thing, we're going to be there. Go out and meet the Saints, you think, maybe they've turned the corner, and then to dish up a performance like that and hear trends like this, I would be quite angry.
Yeah, and right now, think about this. How many sides, right now, this moment, do we know 100% are worse than Essendon? West Coast? North?
Probably Hawthorn.
I reckon the list probably ends there. You know 100% Hawthorn.
Well, who else might be in
Essendon
that?
Essendon is better.
Maybe Richmond in there, Hawthorn in there.
Yeah, but they're all in that same area, in my opinion. Yeah. I don't think you can sit here right now and say without any doubt that Essendon is a better side than Hawthorn or Richmond.
Yeah, that's fair. The disappointing thing as well is you get someone like Archie Perkins, who has such a bright start to the year, now out maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks with a hamstring. I don't think Jordan Ridley's playing before the bye.
Yeah, he's done another. He's re-injured his quad.
It's just starting to look really grim already for Essendon this
and
season.
We saw, I mentioned before, but we saw once the year was gone how the wheels just fell off. The way in which the last year ended for the Bombers was catastrophic. And there is a risk of that happening again, where it's, you have the off-season to sort of shake that off and prepare again for this year. And before you know it, it just snowballs out of control and your year's gone. And the worry and the concern for Bombers fans and that could happen again.
Yeah.
A similar type drop-off. Occurs again this year and earlier.
Are these the kind of stats that are sending alarm bells through Champion Data offices? If you see this kind of stuff, you know, not in isolation, but all together. Is this something where you go, wow, this team's probably not good?
Yeah, exactly. And we try to, you know, not have any bias or look at, you know, it's just a raw number. We're not looking at Essendon and having a logo above the numbers. Just you can bring up a table and have not know who the team is and just have a look at the table and say, where's this team
tracking? Is this a bottom 14?
You know, and I think looking at those numbers so far, yes, this year. And last year, as I said, the only thing that probably kept them out of the bottom four was that they were the second. But, you know, once they got the ball in their hands, they could do something with it. That's completely dried up.
Mm.
Yeah, it's clearly, as I said, there's, go back to the 17th and 18th theory, there is some stats that they rank 17th in this year where West Coast or North are actually better than them. So it's looking bleak.
There's your podcast title for the week, Jake. Why the Bombers are bottom four.
Like the bottom. Well, it's good. Well done, Christian. I like that.
Hey.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So just letting the listeners a little bit know a little bit more about how we sort of operate on this podcast. On a Sunday or a Monday, basically we'll throw about 20 things at Christian in an email. Basically,
we thought about this.
Can you quantify this? All this kind of stuff.
You're very fast as well with how quick you find this stuff and get back to us, I must say.
At least he sends an email saying, I'll look into it. And you know that he's going to be like looking into it for the next couple of hours. But basically, we kind of do this. And all the thing I always throw in at the bottom is, is there anything else that sort of took your eye or took your interest in the Champion Data offices? Because, of course, we can't be across every little thing. Yeah. And the office, I guess you guys would have these kind of, you know, discussions in, you know, week to week about trends and stuff like that. And so I always say, what might be something that, you know, you guys sort of talking about that we might not be? And yeah. I think this week, from this round alone, you've sent through about 10 different really interesting stats, some of these records as well. So we might whip through these because I found these quite funny and quite interesting. I guess starting off with... well, the Brisbane had 23 scoring shots from forward half chains, which was their third most ever. And they also won the I-50 count by 40, which is their most ever. So they had an offensive powerhouse against North Melbourne. But I guess take it away from there because there's some really good stuff here.
Yeah, and again, we've just spoken about Essendon and defence and things like that. So this guy is probably doing it as a one-man band down there. But Ben McKay has been a good pickup for them, no matter what the results say. He's had 27 intercept possessions over the last 2 weeks. So that's the second most for an Essendon player on record across a two-week period. Sort of equal 30th in the comps. So there's been other teams that have had defenders.
He's been coming down there a lot against
exactly,
Friday night.
Yeah, but the last 2 weeks he has stood up tall. I think he's been doing the job that they've recruited him for. I can't put him down as a failed pickup for him. He's been good this year, and I think he'll be good for the next 4 or 5 years. They can build a defence around him. Matt Crouch is one of the favourites that we love to talk to, and I'm so up and down on Matt Crouch. I'm big on if a guy can get the ball 30 times, you have to play him.
You can't.
I'm big
bad.
On that. Everybody is trying to win the same ball, and if he can do it 30 times, then there must be something good about it. But everyone, you're starting to hear about it in the media, and everyone else is right. It's the players you play around him in the midfield that he's working around. And he just doesn't get those metres gained in a lot of sort of little short dumpy disposals and things like that out of packs. But yeah, he had 108 metres gained on the weekend
disposals.
And had over 30 disposals. So that was the fewest metres gained for a player with at least 30 disposals. And he had the 10 plus kicks since 2016. So there's a few guys
so
that had...
So he's kicking it. He's
kicking it sideways.
There's a few guys that had 4 kicks and 25 handballs that might have had lower metres gained. But to have the 30 plus disposals the 10 plus kicks...
I still don't look at that and think
4
that's,
per disposal.
Yeah, but I still don't look at that and think that's bad.
We've talked about this a couple of weeks ago.
It's just a quirky stat. Yeah.
What are the turnovers like? It's fair enough if he's getting no meters gained, he's turning the ball over every second time with a 3-meter hand pass.
I think if you were playing, you know, put it to like a video. If you're playing a video game, that's hard to do. You know what I mean? Like, if you were playing AFL Live 2023 and you had 30 disposals as one of the players, it would be hard to only have 108
meters. This includes you running with the ball. So it's from you taking possession to disposal. So it's not just he's doing
four,
2 meters handball.
4 meters of disposal?
Including his run and carry and everything.
That's between me and Christian.
Who was I talking about before, like, a few weeks ago? Lloyd Meek or someone. He was minus 12 and you didn't even bat an eye to that.
Yeah, a different sort of player, though. He's a ruckman.
Doesn't matter. Looking.
Anyway, let's continue down the list. This is good stuff.
Judd McVie had a pretty good opening quarter in the opening quarter of Gather Round. It was first quarter back in Thursday night, but he had 11 disposals at 100% efficiency and 7 intercepts for the quarter. So he's only the 6th player to sort of have at least 11 disposals at 100% efficiency with the 7 intercepts in a quarter. So two very sort of niche stats together. Sort of no one's had 12 plus at 100% with 7 plus.
Oh, so it's like the intercept mark record.
Yeah,
no one
wants
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
Ties.
So it's 11 effective, you know, as I said, 100% with 11 disposals and the 7 intercepts. 6 players are done, but no one higher. Charlie Curnow's an interesting one. So 12 disposals from 12 marks. This, again, this goes back a little bit to what we were saying last week where Carlton forwards can't get easy ball. This is obviously includes his uncontested marks, but yeah, 12 disposals from 12 marks. It's the highest number of disposals for, you know, to marks on a one-on-one ratio on record. So usually you might see someone take 12 marks, but they've had the 13 disposals.
So every time he took a mark, he had a kick. So
yeah, and vice versa. All of his disposals came via a mark.
But so no one's handballing Charlie.
No, but did he have a mark? And then was there any point where he had a mark, took a mark, and then played on or caught holding the ball so he didn't have a disposal like that?
Ooh, or like took a mark and then the siren went at the end of the quarter?
Yeah, something like that. Because I'm not sure. I did watch it. I should
Harry
know.
Harry Mackay is the one that did take a mark and was running into the open goal and lost the ball. But Curnow, I think, disposed of the ball every
time.
So he
took 12 marks and then 12 kicks straight after it.
Disposal. So there might be
the highest number of disposals
well.
For a 1-to-1 ratio.
Oh, yeah. Disposal, yeah.
So that's interesting. You foreshadowed this one about the free kicks and Carlton and the Fremantle game and all that kind of stuff. But this was really good.
Well, exactly, Rod. And it was a pretty controversial end to the game. But across the whole game, there was 19 goals scored. Yep. 10 of those were from free kicks, which was 6 to Fremantle, 4 for Carlton. It's the highest percentage in a game on record for both teams. So
52.6% of goals were scored from free kicks.
Across
Is that
the
how
whole
we
game.
Want footy to be played, though?
But also, that's the highest on record. That's not the average game. That's just broke the record. Like that is what we see every week. So I think we need to calm down on all of this. What did you say? Carlton had 4, Freo had 6.
Yep.
But everyone will just remember the last,
minute
of the game.
Watching that game, I don't think anything stood out to me as terribly egregious. In terms of none of them were, I mean, you know, aside from
the worst part was what the worst part was not knowing. I know we said we weren't going to talk about it, but it was the not knowing what was going on. And that was me being at the ground. And that's you're just really unsure what's happening. And I'm watching it back on TV.
I was a bit disappointed with TV. We're working live on the game. We have to call what's happening. I don't know how many staff members we had. We were all onto it. We knew straight away. We saw what happened. It was like abuse. We're like, okay. Who's it going to? We didn't know who it was going to, so the process that we got to go is that gives Carlton an inside 50 because a goal's been scored, we're expecting the ball go back to the centre. So once we saw a free kick being paid, I made the call, I said, we need to know who the free kick's going to because it's going to go inside 50 here. The free kick is going to be paid 30 out. So when they decided it was Kennedy, the stats call that we have is Kennedy inside. We weren't sure exactly until we saw the replay, but it was Clark free against for... You know, descent, umpire, whoever it was, Kennedy 3-4. So that's,
but
we needed to know the
Kennedy
inside 50
inside?
First.
Does that mean he
that's
gets an inside 50?
Because we need, so the best, yes,
even though
he
it
does.
Starts there.
He does, and that's
easiest
why.
Inside 50 he's ever had.
Correct, so that's why we probably haven't spoken about inside 50s hugely on this. An inside 50 is just a bookmark.
Yes.
It's not always that person has actually taken the ball
over
the
blue or red line.
You can tackle someone in the goal square and get an inside 50 because that is when the ball has been established.
Yes.
So it's not always a physical stat that happens in inside. And same as a rebound 50, and that's how we understand. So I use inside 50s, I understand that it's not necessarily going to be that guy's actually picked it up and crossed the line with the ball. Mm. Some of the inside 50s are this way. The ball is inside Carlton's forward line, but it should be at the centre square. So we need to establish, how did the ball get in Carlton's forward line? It got in there.
So couldn't it count as a team one, but not a personal one? Why would it be Kennedy?
Nah, just because, again, we probably could, but we try to just identify everything to a player. So there's no, again, when we look at Kennedy and we look at his inside 50 retention rate and things like that, we do need a disposal before that. So he'll get an inside 50 without having, but it won't count towards, was this a retained inside 50 or a lost inside 50? It's just... an inside 50 because we need to establish where the ball is on the ground. And again, as why I sort of say it's a good bookmark because it'll come first because it tells you whatever we call after this yep. is now happening in the forward line.
Okay. In that situation, should it not be the team that wins the free kick so Carlton gets to choose who takes the free kick?
The question I have about this is,
a little bit,
how do we know that yeah. Matthew Kennedy was the closest player?
And that's what I'm saying.
Time.
If Carlton was smart enough, they could have. Because if they could have seen it all happened and you knew you were going to get a free kick, Charlie Kerner or whoever it is just needs to put himself right up in front of the umpire going, what's going on here? Carlton yeah. So again, the umpire's just going to pay it to the first Carlton player he saw, which happened to be Kennedy. So Carlton could have, you know, they got because he kicked the goal anyway, but Carlton could have manipulated that if they were quick enough to decide, mm-hmm. go, hang on, all right, whoever we don't want to take the kick, leave
question
before
for you later on
well, think,
well.
But think about it the other way around. A team that's trailing, that needs a goal as yeah. a minute
you're
to go, rather out. Than going back to a centre bounce and 50-50, okay, let's let this guy that has, it's the equivalent of putting someone on the free throw yeah. line. Late yeah, yeah. in the game, stop the clock, let them hope they miss, and then we get possession. I mean, I know it sounds crazy.
Get the ruckman out of there.
But I think you should be able to pick who takes that kick in that situation.
I disagree, but yeah. I like your thinking, though. Look, I know we've piled on the Bombers a fair bit already, but there's another stat here that jumped out.
And it sort of jumped out the way Brad Scott spoke after the game, said whatever we tried, they just kept, you know.
Did they try? Did,
well, he said they, you know, everything they moved and tried to sort of adjust just made it worse for them. And I thought one of the stats that stood out is they kicked 6 goals from the game. 3 of those goals went straight from the centre bounce, went straight through for a Port Adelaide goal. So half of their goals were backed up within one chain by a Port Adelaide goal. So again, it's the highest percentage in a game. So I'm sure there's been more goals kicked, you know, because it's 3
yeah,
out of
I mean,
6.
It's yeah.
50%, but it is. It's that's got to be frustrating for Essendon as well. It's like, all right, we need to just get 2 in a row here. Let's try to get 2 in a row.
Okay,
you put one through, and the very next centre bounce clearances, they're scoring a goal over your head. So. It was just it lined up with the way Brad Scott was talking after the game, whereas just even when you did something well, i.e. kick a goal, it actually put Port Adelaide in a good spot for them to burst out of the centre and kick a goal themselves. And a couple ones from the Sunday, the last game on Sunday. Carl Amon, I did the game and didn't notice he was racking up the metres in the second half. It's 781 metres gained in the second half. That's the most on a single half on record. So that's first half or second half of a game. Looking at pre-half, so not second and third quarter, we don't sort of count as a half, but yeah.
Yeah, right.
So 700 metres gained to finish with. And just Collingwood, they scored 65 points from forward half chains. That's their most in any game since 2019. Big thing for them is we talk about Carlton and trying to win different ways. So Carlton, so much reliance on stoppages last year and sort of starting to win with a lot more turnovers. Collingwood, we know, haven't been going well. They almost dropped that game, but probably one of the things that they look at is such a big back half scoring team last year and they couldn't lock it in their forward half. And we spoke about their later in the season, they were losing the inside 50 count. They were really playing on the back foot. This is one thing. Yes, they just got over the line, but they can look at this stat and go, okay, we got our forward half territory game going. We were able to lock the ball there and score 65 points from forward half chains, which is something that they weren't in the top 8 for last year by winning a premiership. So just a way that they won a different way.
Interesting stuff.
This Thursday night, so Melbourne and Brisbane, pre-season would have been one of the most anticipated games in the first 5 or 6 weeks of the season. But it also, I guess it is still kind of in a way. You're going to be there,
absolutely,
Jake.
Absolutely, yeah.
Last time they met, obviously, D's won by a point. Kicked 4-5, I think it was, in the last term, and Brisbane only kicked a goal, and they came from behind at the G.
Yep.
Sort of really reinforcing that MCG curse thing. The Ds look like they are going to be a contender this year. Mm-hmm. The Lions we're unsure about because they're still sort of trying to find their way back into this season. What are you most looking forward to going to this game on Thursday night?
That's a question without notice. What am I most looking for? Probably Brisbane's response.
Yeah.
I know response is generally reserved for poor loss and then you see what they do after it. They've finally got a win. It's against a poor side. We know that.
A win's a win.
They should have been winning.
Everyone
that
plays
game.
The poor sides. At least once.
How do they go backing up from that? Mm. The MCG is another question as well. I think there is something to be said about the first visit back to the MCG since the grand final. I think that could help them, as weird as that sounds. I think getting back out on that ground where they had that heartbreak, I think that could be a good thing. And I also think Melbourne, they're probably not going as well as what the record and everything suggests. They've been accurate, they've taken their chances, the teams that they've played probably haven't, and those games could have easily gone the other way, I think. So I don't think the gulf between these two sides is that big. I would not be surprised if Brisbane beat them.
Well, just on the lines, and again, we spoke about Essendon and just looking through the numbers and taking, totally disregarding a win-loss record and things like that. I look at Brisbane and they've still got a good signature and plenty of things to build on. So they're number one for inside 50 differential this season.
Is this obviously inflated, obviously, playing North?
They were plus 40.
Smaller ground as well.
But they were already number one heading into the game.
Okay.
So they'd won it in all three. They lost to Freo and Carlton, but they had won the inside 50 in those two games and beat Collingwood in it. So yeah, it's inflated a bit, but they've been number one and stayed number one after this round. They create the second most forward half stoppages of any team. They win the third most forward half clearances of any team. And they create the most forward half intercepts of any team. So, again, can dominate their territory.
A lot of good things.
Yeah.
12th at converting a forward half stoppage or forward half clearance into a score. They're 12th. And they're 14th at converting that forward half turnover. So, again, a lot of it is just that finish. It's just the process is there, the ability to lock the ball there and get the ball back. It's just finishing off
but
in front
I think
of goal.
That will come.
And again, like, you just look at their shot accuracy this year. They're at 45%, which is slightly below the comp average. They're giving up 60% still. So the accuracy, that's going to come back as well. And I think if they just keep creating these forward half stoppages, winning the time in forward half, the scores
well, I mean,
are
it's a
come.
Much closer game than what the records and everything would suggest.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. Essendon and the Bulldogs on Friday night, equally fascinating for a couple of reasons, because the Dogs are one of those teams. I just don't understand. I don't get them. They have all this talent on paper. You looked at the stat line from the weekend and you had these prime movers getting 30 and kicking a goal and getting 35 and 19 clearances, Libba having all this ball. And they still just can't convert it into midfield dominance. You talk about the Cats going into that game as probably they would be struggling to match the Bulldogs. It didn't matter in the end. They still won the game. So like this matchup is quite fascinating because we've obviously talked about the Bombers and where their deficiencies can be. But the Bulldogs also have their own. And that's sort of, I mean, I don't know what it is. What do you kind of sense from this Friday night clash about where the Dogs are going to be able to try and beat the Bombers?
It is. It's going to be their skill. So as I spoke about, Essendon last year had the best kicking efficiency and disposal efficiency of any team. They've dropped to 17th this year. Bulldogs are now number one for sort of best team at going from back 50 to forward 50, so best team for ball movement, number one for kicking efficiency, number one for kick rating, which takes into account what you're trying to do. So they've got pure skill. Second in a lot of these stats is Port Adelaide. So you've just seen what Port Adelaide was able to do against Essendon. If Essendon drop their pressure away, then Port Adelaide will just make you pay with high skill. It's that trade-off that we spoke about the Bulldogs 2 weeks ago, though. These numbers aren't anything new for the Bulldogs. They're great at using the ball. They're great at sharing around. It's how much value can they actually get
converting
once they get in front of the goal. So we know Essendon's defence has struggled. As I said, Bulldogs, this year they've gone number one for moving the ball from the back end. They were sort of down bottom three last year. What that's helped them this year is they are the second best at scoring a goal per inside 50 this year. So they're scoring a goal from 27% of entries. Last year they were 15th. So because their ball movement was so stagnant and took a long time to get up there, when they did get it there, they struggled to score a goal. This year, I know that, again, the ledger isn't in their favour on the win-loss quite yet, but they are scoring a goal much better because they are sort of moving the ball more purely from the back end and across the field. So that's the worry for Essendon, is if they sort of produce anything similar to what they did against Port Adelaide last week, the Bulldogs can do the exact same thing as Port Adelaide done. Port Adelaide do it with a lot fewer disposals, but Bulldogs are very good at just maintaining possession, beating you in uncontested possessions and going from there. So yeah, an interesting watch in terms of, I think it's Essendon's pressure that'll have a lot of bearing on this game of, clearances, contests, you can go even and things like that. But if Essendon don't bring the pressure and make the Bulldogs sort of turn into sloppy ball users, they'll be in for a sort of a world.
Pressure's one of the easier things to bring, you would think, as well. I mean, it's effort, isn't it?
You would think, but
who you got?
Why can't it be brought every week if it's effort?
That's a great question. Who you got Friday night?
I think, looking at those two games that we just said, I think Brisbane's a massive chance to win, and I think the Bulldogs win.
Fair enough. Is this hype justified or is it hyperbole? Our favourite segment, Jake, straight away for you.
Yes.
Is Alistair Clarkson really the man to lead North Melbourne out of their position anchored at the bottom of the ladder?
Look, I think he is, but it's going to take some time. And I think this is what I was big on when North first signed him 18 months ago, roundabout. Everyone thought he's going to go there. He's just going to have an immediate impact because he's this master coach. Doesn't work out that way. And we haven't really seen too much improvement with North in that time. The numbers would suggest that, as you said, they're 17th or 18th for basically everything before he got there. when he took over, and now a year and a half, or year and a little into his tenure. So I think he can, but...
How much patience, though?
But well, I think they will be patient, because what's the alternative for North? And they have committed to him long term. But yeah. It's more about Alistair Clarkson and the perception around how good he is and how much impact he can have just must change. He is not... No one coach can go into any club, particularly a poor one, and just turn it around like that. It just does not happen. And you can look at, you know, his record. So his record since 2019, 26 wins, 2 draws, 50 losses, 33% rate. Now, that's including Hawthorn, who weren't that bad then, and on obviously his early stint at North Melbourne. The only coaches with a worse winning record: David Noble, Sam Mitchell, Stuart Dew, Matty Nix. Now, they're either coaches that have been shown the door or are under pressure. So, you know, and you put Alistair Clarkson's name in that group. That's not a small sample size. We're talking about a five, six-year period now. This is a long period of time that we have enough of a sample to sort of say, how good of a coach is he?
Yeah.
And that's the question I want to put to you. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. Is he still the same coach he was? Has the game changed? Has the game gone past him? Has he lost his fastball? What do we think about Alistair Clarkson now?
Well, you know, you're looking at some of these stats and some other ones. So he's conceded 100 points, the fifth most in that time, so yeah. Since 2019. His average losing margin is 31 points, the seventh worst. And has only won 38.5% of quarters in that time, which is the second fewest. But you need to look at North as well. And since 2019, North, 18th points for, 18th points against, 18th points from turnover differential, 18th points from clearance differential. So any ways of scoring. So... It's a basket case.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. It's like...
How much blame falls on him? And I know he's only been there for a short period.
No, not much at all. And this is the thing that I don't get with coaches. It's the same with like Adam Simpson. It's like, yes, the decisions that he was a part of led to West Coast falling off the cliff. But replacing him isn't going to be this silver bullet.
That's where I'm at. It's probably... Clarkson's probably the perfect person in this, because he's probably one that can weather the storm. It's not going to hurt his job. If you got a brand new coach... You know,
why is he the perfect person?
Because what's Johnny Toogood going to do any different?
No other coach is going to just get them straight out of the doldrums. It's going to take whoever's there. It's going to take them 2 or 3 years. If I'm a brand new coach, do I get the two? Does a Josh Carr who comes across from Port Adelaide goes to a North Melbourne...
So you're saying Clarkson can do it because he'll be afforded the time to be able to do it.
Afforded the time. It's
stability. Yeah. That counts for things, you know, I think. And
but if you said to any of these other coaches that will give you 5 years, 6 years, 7 years,
he's earned that
they're probably going to be able to do it, because in that amount of time, you're going to bank up enough talent.
He has the runs on the board.
Yeah, you've got to appease sponsors, you've got to appease fans. So if you put an untried bloke in and say, we're going to give him 5 years and he loses for 2 years straight... Everyone's going to come calling for his head, going, he's never proven
to
do anything.
Why are we going to do?
Whereas Clarkson, they can keep. I'm still the best coach.
I'm with you in terms of, I'm not sure where Clarkson of 08 ranks with 15. Clarkson of 24 type thing. That might be a totally different person. But for a club like North to be able to navigate out of this, I think they have the right person in there. They're saying, hey, this person has previous success, a lot of success in his history. We're going to give him time, and there's not going to be success for 2 years, but we're going to trust this bloke that we'll give him 5 years. As I said, a new person's not going to have the same trust from in-house and also from all the sponsors and fans.
Maybe 2008 Clarkson and 2024 Clarkson are the exact same level of coach. In fact, it's probably right. But the point is that it's the players that make the difference, right? And the talent of the Hawthorn team of 2008 and the North Melbourne team of 2024, the gulf between them is massive. And I've been so big on this for years, is that the coach gets too much credit in good teams.
Okay, really, really quickly, because we need to move on. Would you fire him?
It goes back to the first thing I said here. He is probably, for Christian's point, no one's going to be given more time than him. He is he's the darling. He is the master coach. Everyone bows down to him. He will be given time. No one's going to call for his sacking. But the numbers say that nothing's really improved in this period of time so far. And if he really was that coach that everyone thinks he is, you would think we would start to have seen some improvement, and I don't think we have.
Fair enough. Take a deep breath. Christian, players need to get sneakier with their game management and, dare I say it, gamesmanship late in tight games.
Yes. So...
it's a bit of a niche question.
Yeah, he's going to explain it, I'm hoping.
Yeah. So there was one that caught my eye on the weekend where Braden Fiorini, at the end of the second quarter, it was actually a free kick to Noah Anderson. So Noah Anderson kicks the ball forward and gets paid an after-disposal free for him. There's 8 seconds left on the clock, and the umpire pays a free kick downfield to Braden Fiorini. So we know benches and things are holding up signs. We know players are so well drilled into situational game awareness and all this sort of stuff. So he should have known that there was at least 8 seconds, or he would have known that he was going to have the last kick of the quarter just before halftime. I've watched Braden Fiorini. You've watched Braden Fiorini for probably 4 or 5 years. I've never seen him kick the ball 55 metres. So he's 55 out, had to kick over a man on the mark. It's not an easy kick for anyone to have. But I just thought, you're probably the least likely to do it. I would love to see a play, and again, I would prefer everyone just to play the game on its merits, but there is a rule that says if you're injured and can't take your kick, a teammate can come and take that kick for you. If you're smart enough or quick enough
to come around the back.
Well, I was going to say, famously led to the Jordan Dawson goal in the showdown.
Yes, the Lockie Murphy one. Why didn't Fiorini sort of have that sort of quickness to think, well, I can't kick 50. The two guys around me.
Can you come back on? If you go off.
It's half time, yes. You don't even have to go off.
So you can just say, I've got a sore calf.
I've been poked in the eye and I can't quite see. I don't want to waste time to get this guy to take my kick.
This is outrageous coming from him.
Exactly.
Well, where do you draw the line?
This is not when the first time I thought about it. So this is, I thought about this as probably as a, I think it was 2011. So Robbie Warnock, great Carlton ruckman, took a mark in front of goal. A minute 20 left
against
to go
Geelong.
Against Geelong at Marvel Stadium. Took a mark and went down quite heavy and was quite injured.
He was concussed.
He took a while to get up. Was he concussed? Did he come out concussed?
Well,
I didn't know at the time that he was concussed, but he took a while to get up.
Do you remember this?
Standing next to him is Chris Judd, Jeff Garlett, and Brendan Favola. He still goes back, gets his composure, takes all this time, trainers around him, everything. I'm yelling out from the crowd, someone else take the kick. You can't kick the, you're the least likely to kick his 15 out slide angle. He takes his kick, misses, Carlton loses the game.
Yeah.
Lockie Murphy, Jordan Dawson, there was that sort
of... Where
do
you draw the line, though? Because
who do you allow to take it?
If you were Patrick Cripps and you take a mark 30 out on a tight angle in the forward 50, wouldn't you just go, oh, I've got a cramp halfway through the second quarter?
And wouldn't you do... Yeah.
Harry Mackay. If you, every single time someone harder than your best
ball. If you've got a dead eye in your team,
if I've got a player doing that that can't
you
can't be playing Patrick Cripps every game.
This might be the worst idea you've brought to this podcast.
As I said, you need to be able to back yourself. I don't agree with that one, 30 metres out. If a guy can't have a shot for goal 30 metres out, then he shouldn't be playing the AFL. Not everyone can kick 55 metres.
Yes.
But it's so the same thing.
It was the Fiorini one of just thinking, okay, this is the last kick of the half. Game situation just says, we just need to be able to, the best possible chance for us to score with this last kick is if I don't take it.
Designated kick. So to your point.
I don't know where you draw the line, but I think this just needs to be, as I said, coaches talk about game situation, game awareness all the time.
Like,
no one has actually thought this far ahead to think, okay, where if a guy takes a mark in a similar situation, maybe don't take your kick next. Maybe just grab your hammy and sort of
NFL
off
players when they just started flopping for timeouts.
Yeah, it's
games.
Pathetic.
Yeah.
I got one for you. I think it's the final one. Ollie Wines, Brownlow medalist Ollie Wines, is still crucial to Port Adelaide's centre bounce lineup.
That's hyperbole, unfortunately, now these days.
Look at him. He gets a rare one of these and he actually answers it correctly, not like me just launching into whatever I say.
Let's take a look at Port's sort of centre bounce setups for the start of this season. So, you know, Soldo's in there, Rosie's in there, Willem Drew's in there, and Jason Horne-Francis is in there, right? When you're looking at the clearance differential, well, hang on, I'm getting there. When you look at the clearance differential when these guys are in, Soldo, the clearance differential when he's in the centre bounce, plus 17. Clearance differential when Rosie's in there, plus 18. Drew, plus 20. Jason Horne-Francis, plus 11. Wines, plus 4. But crucially, when Soldo's not in there, they're only plus 3. When Rosie's not in there, they're only plus 2. When Drew's not in there, they're even. And when Jason Horne-Francis is in there, they're only plus 1. So the production of clearances when you've got Soldo, Rosie, Drew and Jason Horne-Francis in there, the differential is so much more weighted towards Port Adelaide that Wines is negligible in that spot, unfortunately. And Butters, well, when he's in there, they're plus 9, but when he's out, they're plus 11. So you might as well stick him somewhere else.
Butters and Wines find a new job.
Well, I'm just saying.
You're saying they don't need either.
Find a new role. Ollie Wines been a long servant for that club for a long time.
You're getting rid of Ollie Wines.
No, I'm saying why not look for a team that needs a bit more inside mid grunt that can use that, because at the moment they have one of the best balanced midfields in the competition.
Okay. Well, he's not the kind of player, at least my eye wouldn't say, that he can probably play in another position.
They tried him on the wing last year and moved him back into the middle.
So I. Is it the case of going to another club? Maybe.
Maybe that's the case. There'll be a few teams interested in him.
Bit
I'm
of Tom
sure.
Mitchell kind of situation.
All right, last one, I promise. It's going to go for 5 minutes too.
If I have a fine on my car, I'm going to be really annoyed.
The AFL must come down hard on Jeremy Finlayson for his anti-gay slur, like they did with Taylor Walker for his racist slur. So Taylor Walker got a 6-game ban from the AFL.
From the AFL, yes.
AFL currently, as we are recording, is deliberating. Quote-unquote, what Jeremy Finlayson's punishment for his anti-gay slur on the field should be.
A few things here. Don't know why it's taking the AFL so long. I don't know what they need to do. Jeremy Finlayson has come out and admitted that he said it. This was days ago, and I don't know what we're still investigating.
I think an hour after the game, it was already online.
What do we need to investigate? What do they need to investigate?
So does the remorse count for something?
I think it does. Okay. People will disagree, but I think it does count for something. Now, it shouldn't mean in any way that he gets off. He should cop his ban, whatever it is. Yeah. But I think it does count for something, and the timeliness of it as well. Coming out, as you said, it was
three-quarter time.
It was straight away. The game. It's not like he hadn't had a time to sort of talk to anyone and reflect. It was immediate. Like he's gone to them straight away and told them. I think that should count for something, and I think. As weird as it might sound, I think it's a good message to come out of it, a positive message in the sense that we can have a player like this that is a role model and shouldn't be making these mistakes, mm-hmm. come out and say something like this, which is stupid and wrong, and will cop a penalty, but also isn't afraid to immediately admit it was wrong, and come out and tell people that as opposed to try and double down on it or hide from it. Okay. So I think he gets credit for that. Now, does that outweigh that what he's done? No, it doesn't. And I still think he will cop a ban and should cop a ban. Is it going to be 6 weeks like Walker? I'm not sure because we saw...
If the AFL came out and said it was, would you say, you know what, fair enough, don't do it. It's you know, we're beyond that as a society.
If he gets a 6-week ban or a 4-week ban, I'm not going to be too concerned either way. But I do think the remorse counts for something. The problem where it gets a little bit murky is... Going back to Alistair Clarkson, now he had a similar incident and was given a $20,000 fine. Now I know it's different player coach, but is it really different?
Why? I was about to ask you why. They both were out on the football field. They were both directed to an opposition player. So why is it different?
I don't know. I don't think it shouldn't necessarily be different. So, but is that the precedent set now? Because that is the precedent for it. It's not Walker. I know.
I would have thought Walker probably is the closer player. Slur.
I think it's more likely it will be games than a fine. It might be both. I'm not sure, but it goes back to the first point. Don't know why it's taking so long. I think the AFL needs to come out because by dragging it out, it almost gives that feeling of, it's not important. It should be like this is straight away. You can't do this. Here's the penalty straight away.
Fair enough. Thanks for sticking with us. I know it's been a bit of a longer episode. Plenty to get through, and we've really enjoyed it. Stick around for Red Time Thursday as well. I'll be back.
And stick around and find out whether I do have that fine on my car.
We'll let you know as well. That'll be fun. To everyone at home, thanks for joining us. We will speak to you in the next episode.
Thanks for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.